Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you for coming out here. Thanks for giving me the chance to speak with you. The biblical creation account in Genesis chapter 2 and 3 paints a picture of the first man and woman having a relationship with God from the very beginning of their appearance. That is, as soon as there were human beings, they're religious human beings. Modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, are equivalent with Homo religiosus. By Homo religiosus, I mean members of the genus Homo that have the cognitive capacities that enable joint or shared relationships with a god or gods, and some disposition toward exercising this religious faculty. That is, to be a member of Homo religiosus, one must be able to be one of at least two people who believe themselves to be carrying out a relationship with the same god or gods. In contrast to a straightforward reading of the biblical account, Darwinian evolution raises alternative possibilities concerning what it means for humans to be religious beings and when Homo religiosus might have arisen. Probably the most common view is that there's nothing about human nature that makes us particularly inclined toward religion. Sure, we have the cognitive capacities to enable us to entertain beliefs in gods and to have interactive relationships with them, but such cultural expression is comparable to the capacity to play chess or do algebra. The capacity is there, but it's just a matter of cultural accident or historical contingency, whether people become religious or not. Had someone not invented chess, there would not be any chess players. Had no one invented religion, people wouldn't be religious. This view, what I'll call the standard view, fits well with the idea that beliefs and practices are entirely a product of cultural construction, and that there's no such thing as pre-cultural or pan-cultural human nature that might bias people towards some kinds of beliefs and practices rather than others. Another possibility, from a Darwinian perspective, is that modern humans evolved their entire suite of faculties and behaviors, and then something additional evolved in some or nearly all humans that makes them prone to religious thought and action. So first, modern humans evolved, and then at some point later, maybe tens of thousands of years later, Homo religiosus evolved. From this perspective, religion is some kind of additional adaptation, and so I'll call this the adaptation hypothesis. Alternatively, we might suppose that Homo religiosus precedes behaviorally modern humans. That is, maybe, as the adaptationists argue, religion is a special evolved trait, but perhaps it evolved before our ancestors became modern humans. Perhaps Homo erectus was religious, and so were descendants such as the Neanderthals and our ancestors, the anatomically but not behaviorally modern humans. We carry a religious predisposition as part of our very nature, but this is a leftover from our Stone Age past, and maybe we are gradually evolving past Homo religiosus. I'll call this adaptationist view the pre-human religion hypothesis. Okay. Finally, there's the rather improbable-looking view that whatever it is that makes people capable of and sympathetic toward religious thought and action evolved concurrently with whatever it is that makes people behaviorally modern humans. That is, being religious is not an addendum to being a modern human, nor is it a predecessor, but it is among the defining traits of the modern human. Hence, our ancestors did not become religious and then became modern humans, nor did they become modern humans and then at some point acquire a proclivity for religiousness. Rather, whatever it is that makes humans a natural tendency to be religious is the same stuff that makes modern humans distinctive from our predecessors. I will call this the concurrence hypothesis. To some, we have at least four evolutionary possibilities to consider. The standard view that there's nothing about human nature that predisposes us or specially accounts for religious thought and behavior. The adaptation hypothesis that religion is an evolved trait on top of and later than the evolution of whatever it is that makes us behaviorally modern humans. The pre-human religion hypothesis that first religion evolved as an adaptation and then later behaviorally modern humans evolved. And the concurrence hypothesis that whatever it is that makes us behaviorally modern humans is the same thing that makes us religious. What I will do with my time today is evaluate these four possibilities regarding the evolution of religiousness. The standard view is the view that there's nothing about human nature that makes us prone to be religious or to believe in gods. Religion is something of a historical cultural accident, analogous to the invention of modern science or the game of chess. Though we are capable of these forms of cultural expression, they might have never happened. On this view, religion does not have any special place in human nature, and it surely is not an adaptation. The standard view is rooted in the idea that human cognition provides a bias-free, clean slate for experience, including cultural experiences, to ride on unhindered. The environment largely dictates who and what we are. I regard the standard view as problematic, to say the least. Its presumption that human minds can be likened to blank slates or sponges or something like that has been demonstrated to be erroneous many times over. It is simply not the case that humans can learn any information equally well or are equally likely to acquire any ideas or practices they might be exposed to. Such a simplistic view of human cognition and behavior, though still common in neighboring fields, has held no serious place in psychological sciences since the so-called cognitive revolution that began in the 1950s and by the 1970s had overthrown behaviorism's empiricist regime. Though there's still lively disagreement about just what sorts of biases human minds naturally have, how they develop, and so forth, that ordinary human biological endowment plus ordinary features of the world we live in yields a predictable natural mental toolkit is not controversial. Rather than a sponge that soaks in anything or a blank slate ready for any scribbling, the human mind is more usefully likened to a Swiss Army knife, possessing numerous functional units for solving particular problems, arguably problems that were important in our ancestral past. The standard view also looks suspect given some striking divergences from other arbitrary, non-natural forms of cultural expression, such as modern science or playing chess. Cultural expression that is largely unbuckled from natural biases or predilections tends to be extremely variable within and across cultures. So people and some cultures simply do not do modern science, and they don't play chess. In contrast, religious thought and action, perhaps particularly some kind of belief in supernatural agency, is ubiquitous across cultures. Anthropologist Scott Atram puts the place of belief in gods in strikingly strong terms when he writes, "Supernatural agency is the most culturally recurrent, cognitively relevant, and evolutionarily compelling concept in religion. The concept of the supernatural is culturally derived from an innate cognitive schema." Notice that Atram links the high recurrence of religion and religious thought to some kind of natural predisposition. He even dares to use the term innate, and I don't, but he does. But it isn't just the greater recurrence of religious thought as compared with chess playing or modern science that suggests it's a different kind of cultural expression. We might also point to its relative ease of transmission to, you know, one to another, or even to very young children, and its resilience in the face of deliberate attempts to eliminate it. Okay, if governments systematically tried to snuff out chess playing, they would probably succeed. These sorts of considerations regarding the resilience, the ubiquity, and the ease with which even young children acquire religion has prompted many scholars to explore why is it that humans seem so prone to religious expression? Why is it so common? Why is it so easy for children to acquire? In short, why does it seem that religion is part of human nature? That scholars are making progress on these sorts of questions is evidence in itself that the standard view is mistaken. So we'll turn to some other hypotheses. The adaptation hypothesis is that religious belief and practice amount to an evolved propensity that arose after our ancestors had become behaviorally modern humans. That is, religion is something extra added that was added because it helped our ancestors survive and reproduce better than modern humans who lacked religion. Adaptationist arguments tend to focus on the ability for morally interested superhuman agents to police human action in social arrangements. The basic argument is fairly straightforward. It is an advantage for members of a social group to share and trade. Sometimes our hunting, gathering, or farming are more successful than other times. If we share with each other, then we level out the boom and bust cycles for everyone. Likewise, if I'm a great hunter, but you're a great clothing maker, it might be best for both of us for me to give you meat in exchange for clothing. But such resource sharing typically requires a degree of trust. I'm asking for clothing now, but I have to pay you meat later. Will I actually come through, or will I cheat you? Will you really give me meat if I fail to find game one day when you're successful, or will you hide what you caught and not tell me about it? Or knowing that you're better at gathering than I am, and knowing that you're generous, why should I work so hard? I'll let you gather and give it to me. Maybe I should just do enough work so you don't think I'm a freeloader. So you see, cooperation has potential costs as well as benefits. Of course, one way of handling the free rider problem is to punish cheaters when they get caught, and punish them severely. The downside is you have to expend energy catching and punishing these cheaters. And cheaters could just simply get better at not getting caught. You could have an arms race problem. And then there's the second order free rider problem. Some people might not punish cheaters because it is too costly to them. Okay, I'm going to punish the cheaters, but will you punish cheaters too? But then what about those who fail to punish those who fail to punish? And those who fail to punish those who fail to punish those who fail to punish? As you can see, cooperation carries some problems. Enter the gods. Some scholars in the area, such as Dominic Johnson and Jesse Baring, have suggested that gods help arrest this punishment regress. If gods do the punishing, we don't have to do so much. Another upside of gods policing human behavior is that gods, by sake of being invisible, mind-reading, all-knowing, omnipresent, or able to see through walls, know with greater fidelity who is a cheat and who isn't. If the gods punish, we know they got it right. I might mispunish. They have what Pascal Boyer has called full access to strategic information about humans. Sort of the great cosmic gossip or something like that. People that believe in a morally interested, full access agent, such as a god of the sort that I'm talking about, are less likely to cheat on you. So they're more reliable as sharing and trading partners. And more people want to share and trade with them. Hence, they will have better access to resources than less trustworthy individuals. If I trust you, I'm more willing to engage in trade. Okay? But that makes you wealthier. You get more stuff because people trust you. This resource advantage will make them fitter to survive and reproduce. And so their genes that make them God believers will be reinforced through natural selection. All right? That's the basic account. Two sorts of evidence would be helpful to support the adaptation hypothesis. Evidence that there is a particular gene that promotes religiousness, and evidence that being religious really is adaptive. Is there such evidence? On the first score, is there a religion gene or a God gene or something like that? Sensational titles and headlines aside, the evidence to date is pretty thin. Certainly, there appears some heritable component in what has been labeled religiosity. But whether this is a disposition toward believing in gods, or toward ritualism, or in-group conformity, or some other feature of modern religiosity in the contemporary Western societies is unclear. In his book, The God Gene, Dean Hamer admits that the gene that he has identified and called the God Gene is related, and that he's identified as having something, some relationship with religious identification, manages to explain only a very small fraction of the variance. I mean very, very small. That is, this God gene is a long way from accounting for human religious propensities. And it really is sort of a misnomer to even call it a God gene. The evidence doesn't show any connection with belief in God at all. So far, then, evidence for a particular genetic adaptation that makes people religious who otherwise would not be is far from compelling. The adaptation hypothesis does much better with regard to the second type of evidence. We do have reason to believe that being religious is adaptive. That is, it's good for you and may promote group cohesion and cooperation. Numerous studies have linked high levels of religious commitment and participation with such health and well-being outcomes as fewer medical visits, greater reported happiness and life satisfaction, better coping with stressors, lower incidence of mental illness, and greater longevity. Religious people also tend to have more children than non-religious people. These studies, I mean, it should be said, these studies are a long way removed from the ancestral conditions under which religiousness allegedly evolved in terms of natural and cultural environment, and the mechanisms at play are still very unclear. Nevertheless, they do suggest that religiousness may be adaptive in terms of health, survival, and reproduction. But the theorized adaptationist account isn't that people with the religion gene are somehow healthier because of believing in gods, but that they're more cooperative than their non-religious competitors. Here, too, some evidence supports the adaptation hypothesis. Anthropologist Richard Sosis, for instance, has produced several studies showing that religious communities often outsurvive non-religious ones and are marked by higher levels of cooperation and trust. For instance, in one study, Sosis compared religious and secular kibbutz communities in Israel. Those that were religious had higher levels of trust, cooperation, and were more likely to last over time than their secular comparisons. Similarly, survey data suggests that higher religious commitment predicts greater generosity with time and money. Psychologists have recently shown that religious residents of Vancouver who were subliminally exposed to religious words were significantly more generous in an economic game than atheists subliminally primed in the same way. The question is still open, but there's at least some evidence on this side. Suppose we accept, but for the sake of our argument, suppose we accept that belief in gods and the actions that these beliefs motivate are adaptive. They're good for health, survival, reproduction, and intergroup cooperation. Does it follow that religion is an adaptation? Well, no. Lots of things are or could be adaptive without being adaptations. Yoga may reduce stress and improve fitness, thereby promoting survival and reproductive success, somehow. But surely yoga is not a direct product of genetic selection. Having community fire brigades or rescue corps may improve the fitness of a community, but surely they are not adaptations. Even something as old and as widespread as clothing making, clearly adaptive for living in cold climates, is an implausible candidate for an adaptation. I find it implausible and unparsimonious to suppose that behaviors such as clothing making are the result of a genetic mutation when our ancestors, presumably, already possessed the ability to use tools. Chimps can do it and so can birds. Detect patterns, reason causally, and solve problems. Similarly, it seems unlikely that what is captured by religion is the result of a single genetic adaptation. Consider what that would mean. Belief in gods, belief in the afterlife, reasoning as if gods are morally interested in human activity and that they will act on that interest to punish or reward, seeing natural phenomena as indicators of divine action, and socially organizing around these beliefs as opposed to others, all would be products of the same genetic modification. I suppose it's possible, but I doubt it. And if the selective pressure was intergroup trust and cooperation for shared resources, why not a simpler mutation that made us all hypervigilant do-gooders? Or how about some kind of gentle paranoia that somehow, whenever we are bad, someone is bound to catch us? Introducing religion to solve this cooperation problem seems to me a little like trying to kill a gnat with a hand grenade. So for these reasons, among others, though religion may be adaptive, I suspect it is not an adaptation. What then about the pre-human religion hypothesis? The pre-human religion hypothesis is that at some point before becoming modern humans, our ancestors acquired religion as an adaptation through natural selection. Then, at a later date, they acquired additional adaptations that cumulatively made them behaviorally modern humans. What reasons might we have for thinking that anyone other than behaviorally modern humans had a comparable religious sentiment or predisposition that I'm calling homo religiosus? Well, frankly, we have very little reason. And at least to my knowledge, no one working in the cognitive and evolutionary sciences of religion is seriously advancing the pre-human religion hypothesis. So you might wonder why I'm wasting your time with it. Well, it's a logical possibility. And that said, some archaeologists argue that Neanderthals, for instance, were religious. This claim is based on evidence that Neanderthals occasionally buried their dead with grave goods in a way that suggested ritualized treatment of the remains. And perhaps a belief in the afterlife. Maybe some Neanderthals did have a belief in the afterlife that motivated the seemingly ritualized burial practices. Or perhaps they simply regarded the bodies and possessions of deceased loved ones as somehow special and uncanny, without any worked out ideas about what happens after death. We don't know. Either way, we don't have strong evidence that Neanderthals had the kind of fully developed religious beliefs and practices that modern humans have been expressing for thousands of years. Another non-human species that has been cited as possibly having some kind of religious sentiment is chimpanzees. Don't laugh, it's true. Male chimpanzees have been known to make dominance displays, the sort they use in confrontation with other males in response to waterfalls, thunderstorms, and even motor vehicles. Does this mean chimpanzees are panomorphizing the natural world, much like humans anthropomorphize the natural world in religious contexts? Well, it's hard to know. It could be that chimpanzees have a behavioral routine, this dominance display that's called a rain dance, it's called, that usually gets triggered only in the presence of competing males. But occasionally, natural or human-made sights and sounds satisfy the input conditions to get these routines going. So they start doing their little dance. Likely, these rain dances, as they've been called, are more similar to horses running from harmless plastic grocery sacks blowing in the wind than to humans regarding hurricanes as divine judgment for misdeeds. But I suppose we just don't know. But a further problem lurks for the pre-human religion hypothesis, and that's simply that as an adaptation account, the pre-human religion hypothesis also shares the same liabilities that I've already ticked through for the adaptation hypothesis. And so, for lack of evidence and plausibility, I suspect that the pre-human religion hypothesis is not a good starter. So that leads me to the concurrence hypothesis. In my introduction, I said that the concurrence hypothesis appears improbable. This hypothesis suggests that whatever it was that made behaviorally modern humans happened to appear at the same time as our religious predisposition. Those capacities that prompt us to be religious happen to be the same capacities that make modern humans cognitively and behaviorally distinct. Becoming modern humans and becoming homo religiosus, then, are one and the same. On the surface, I'll grant this seems like an extremely unlikely proposition. But let me try to persuade you that the concurrence hypothesis is a real possibility, and perhaps even at least a little more probable than the other two hypotheses that I've offered. Okay? To build my case, I will quickly sketch three accounts for why humans are naturally disposed to be religious that have been developed by cognitive scientists of religion. What these accounts have in common is that instead of proposing special genetic mutation or mutations that give rise to religiousness, they observe that features of ordinary human cognitive systems that might have evolved for entirely different reasons in our ancestral past may encourage the religiousness of modern humans. The cognitive area's earliest account, developed by anthropologist Stuart Guthrie, is that because of the importance of detecting predators or prey, friends or foe, we have evolved a tendency to over-detect human-like beings in our environment. That is, we have a tendency to anthropomorphize objects and states of affairs in the natural world, says Guthrie. Guthrie argues that such a tendency leads to the postulation of gods. Considerable research has been devoted to understanding the human agency detection device, or ADD, as it has sometimes been called. This ADD, attention detection device, is regarded as being evolved to detect the presence of minded, intentional beings, even under conditions in which evidence is scant or inconclusive. The evolutionary argument for this hair trigger detection is that the cost of failing to detect a predator or prey, a friend or foe, would be so great that the agency detection device is better tuned to generate false positives, occasionally detecting agents when there are none, then false negatives, missing agents when they're around. And certainly, experimental evidence suggests that infant and adult humans can be led to regard even geometric shapes as minded entities under certain conditions. All it takes are certain seemingly non-inertial, goal-directed movements, such as when an object launches itself toward another object. So the agency detection device may be a little hypersensitive under certain conditions. Hence, it is sometimes, for emphasis, called the hypersensitive agency detection device, or HAD. Sorry about that. I know it's a mouthful. So we just use HAD. It's a lot shorter. The idea is if I wander through an allegedly haunted house and I hear chains rattling, I might regard the sound of chains as produced by a ghost. The chains are the product of intentional action, but are not the agent. Okay, so one important feature of this agency detection device, and maybe one of the features that would separate it from its predecessors in non-humans, is that it not only detects agents, but signs of agency. Okay? Perhaps animals, well, and I should say, we don't really have any evidence, not at least I don't think very compelling evidence, that non-humans have that kind of agency detection device. Animals will certainly avoid signs of human agency, like roads and buildings and noises. But perhaps animals are shy of human buildings and roads, not because they understand them to be signs of human agency. Ooh, someone did this on purpose, but perhaps they're just learned to associate these strange things with danger and do not entertain the contents of human mental states at all. Even if we give non-human animals the benefit of the doubt in these situations, however, humans can do something more complex still. Not only do we regard states of affairs as products of intentional activity of an unseen agent, but we then speculate what the intentions of the unseen agent might have been. Okay. Why did it do this? Oh, it's indicating this kind of a belief or that kind of desire. It wants this. It's telling me to go away. Even if members of Pan and the extinct Homo had such capacities, these are still insufficient to be counted as homo religiosus. I keep stringing you along. It's still not enough. The ability to suppose that the thunderstorm was caused by a god, and even perhaps because the god is angry, is not quite sufficient for religion. Something else is needed. I'm not going to tell you what that something else is just yet. Another cognitive account is offered by Yale psychologist Paul Bloom. I'm sorry, this is going to seem like gobbledygook probably at first, so let me walk you through it. He notes that developmental psychology has produced evidence that from early in childhood we have at least two different conceptual systems that both have to be used to make sense of the behavior of humans. One system deals with the properties and motion of physical bodies. Okay, our bodies are bounded physical objects and have all of the properties of those sorts of things, have to be supported or they fall to the ground, can't pass through other solid objects, I won't try it, it'll hurt, all kinds of different properties like that. Okay, so we're solid physical objects. And another system, the theory of mind system, that tries to explain and predict behavior based on mental states, beliefs, desires, goals, feelings, dispositions, and so forth. This theory of mind system, or TOM it is called in the literature, theory of mind, TOM, so we've got HAD and TOM now, is much newer in terms of both evolution and development. Okay, lots of animals have this kind of theory of physical body system. It doesn't look like many animals. It's arguable which ones, but certainly the more advanced primates have some kind of rudimentary theory of mind system. At least it looks like it, and maybe a few other species, but not, say, small-brained cotton-top tamarins. But yet they've got this sort of theory of bodies. So we have these two different systems with different evolutionary histories and different developmental pathways, too. The body system seems to be in place in the first 3 months of life in infants. Okay, they have solid expectations that young. If you're interested, you can ask me later how we know that. But the mind system doesn't seem to really develop and especially approach its mature adult form until fourth, fifth, sixth year of development. Okay? To reason about humans, then, we have to bring these two systems together and hold them together to make sense of human behavior. Why did he do that? Well, partly it's because of the properties of him as a physical object, but partly it's because of his beliefs, desires, wants, goals, intentions, and so forth. Bloom has argued that because we have these two different systems, and they have different input conditions, and they have different expectations, they produce intuitive dualism. That's what he calls it, intuitive dualism. And he argues that all humans, regardless of culture, are intuitively dualistic when it comes to minds and bodies. The two are separable because they're conceptualized using two different systems. Okay? Given this intuitive dualism, the idea that some part of a person can continue existing and even acting after death is natural, says Bloom. This isn't a surprising thing. And so the slightest encouraging evidence, perhaps provided by Had, or corroboration from trusted others, may be enough to get afterlife beliefs up and running. Similarly, Pascal Boyer has proposed that human corpses are perceived in a unique way because of conflicts between several specialized inference systems. Notably, the animacy system, that's a little bit like Bloom's sort of body system, and the person file that holds details pertaining to a specific known person. Maybe you've had this kind of experience that Boyer points to. Seeing the corpse of a family member or a loved one prompts uneasiness, a sort of uncanny feeling, because the animacy system tells us the body is dead, the person is not living. But the person file, with the aid of theory of mind, Tom here, refuses to stop producing inferences about the dead person's wants, needs, beliefs. So-and-so would have really liked this. Oh, don't say that, because so-and-so wouldn't like that. Okay? Bloom and Boyer's accounts help explain why the idea that some human spirit survives death and continues to act in the world may be the most widespread and oldest of religious concepts. But only believing that the ancestor spirits can continue to act in the world and speculating about their goals, wants, beliefs does not get us all the way to religion. Something else is still needed. But before I get to that something, allow me one more set of cognitive dynamics that may encourage belief in gods. Psychologist Deborah Kellerman has suggested that children may be intuitive theists for a completely different set of reasons. She has conducted dozens of experiments with children and adults that show a strong tendency to see natural things, such as rocks, plants, and animals, as purposefully designed. Okay? Her research and that of others has also shown that young children assume that purposeful design requires a designer. Indeed, until Darwin, essentially everyone assumed design requires a designer. And so children are prone toward believing in some kind of intelligent being or beings that account for the natural world. In fact, this propensity is so strong that it's been shown in some other studies that regardless of what parents and teachers teach about, say, the evolutionary origins of certain features of animals, children don't buy it. Until they're about 10, children don't look like their parents and teachers. They prefer creationist accounts, or even emergentist accounts. They really don't like Darwinism. Why? It's counterintuitive. The natural world looks designed to them. Now, you might think that we outgrow that predisposition. But Kellerman's studies, at least she's got a really recent study that actually isn't published yet, but I'll tell you about it anyway if you promise not to tell everyone else. She's showing that this tendency to prefer teleological, purpose, design explanations for natural things persists into adulthoods, even with scientifically trained people, if you crank up the time demands of the task. So if you ask scientists to evaluate explanations for a natural phenomenon, and you give them all the time in the world, they reject the teleological ones. Oh, no, no, science doesn't work that way. There's no design behind this feature of the natural world. Leaves aren't that way for a purpose. That's just natural selection has done this. Okay, they reject the teleological explanations. But if you have them evaluate, is this a good explanation or not, quickly, suddenly they start saying the teleological ones, the design explanations, are good explanations, whereas other match control explanations are still bad ones. Okay, it's not just that error rate goes up. It's that error rate goes up in a particular direction. Okay? We all feel that tug, that these design explanations seem like pretty good ones. We have to kind of override that, tamp it down. No. I've been trained otherwise. Okay? So Kalman's argument is that from childhood, we have this, what she calls promiscuous teleology. Okay? We apply teleological reasoning in places that our parents just wouldn't approve of. Okay? All over the place. And that helps support the idea that, well, someone did it, not something did it. Well, by around age 3, 4, children already know people are not those who would account for the natural world. This is ridiculous. That maybe you can see the little people here that have built this mountain. It's just not the way children think. They know very quickly limitations on their parents and other adults. And so they're left with this sort of tacit question. Who did it? Introduce a god and you've got a winner. Okay? That's Kellerman's basic account. But that's not enough. These three accounts, Guthrie's anthropomorphism account, Bloom's intuitive dualism account, and Kellerman's intuitive theism account, each have evidence in their favor, experimental kinds of evidence and other considerations, and they could be combined, I should say. For instance, this intuitive dualism might lead us to suppose that some spirit continues after death. Then my hypersensitive agency detection device had registered some funny sound shortly after the funeral, and I think, what is so-and-so trying to tell me? Okay. And then perhaps this tendency to see the world as design might encourage us to believe that the ancestor spirits actually create and sustain the natural world. Okay? I mean, that's one way of combining these. Other cognitive factors, too, have been scientifically developed that might buttress religiousness. But these three accounts all make use of ordinary cognitive architecture that likely evolved for reasons entirely unrelated to religious belief and practice. And indeed, likely evolved previous to the emergence of behaviorally modern humans. We see signs of these kinds of tendencies in pre-human species. We wouldn't be too surprised if Homo erectus had a hypersensitive agency detection device of some sort, some kind of theory of mind system that enabled them to speculate about the mental states of others and led to intuitive dualism, perhaps. And even a bias to understand the natural world in terms of purpose and design, perhaps leading to speculations that someone intentionally caused elements of the natural world to be what they are. All three cognitive accounts, as I have presented them so far, also lack the same extra factor that would produce real religion. Okay? This is where my argument turns very new. So I'm trying it out on you all, so tell me if it sounds like nonsense. I'm saying that if Homo erectus did have all of that cognitive architecture that I've just talked about, Homo erectus was still not homo religiosus. Okay? Recall that to be homo religiosus, what is needed is to be able to have a joint relationship with God or gods. Homo religiosus must be able to act contingently in response to what they think the god's mental state might be. And they must be able to believe that another shares a similar relation to the same god. Otherwise, we wouldn't have faith communities, we wouldn't have religions, we'd have lots of individual idiosyncratic beliefs and practices that look a lot more like superstitions. Okay? The linchpin that makes this kind of relational religion possible is the cognitive capacity known as higher order theory of mind, or as I prefer, meta-representational theory of mind. Think of it as MTOM, if you like, but meta-representational theory of mind. The ability deliberately and reflectively to think about the contents of others' thoughts. Okay, I call this meta-representational theory of mind because it is the ability to form mental representations about the contents of mental representations. One could think about another's thoughts, about thoughts, including my own thoughts. She knows that I know. She knows what I want. Okay, you follow that? The women go, yeah. And the men go, huh? This is one of these findings. There seems to be a dimorphism here. I can talk about that, but if you want. Meta-representational theory of mind opens new doors for thinking about and relating to gods above and beyond simpler theory of mind abilities. Consider these. I've italicized the mental state terms or references to mental states here. The god has mental states, but I don't know what they are, that motivate the god's actions. And there's our first kind of sentence. The God does not like my behavior and express that dislike by sending illness. You'll see a little bit more mental state activity going on there. The God does not like my behavior and sent illness so that I would know that the God does not like my behavior and I would change. And D, you know that the God does not like my behavior and sent illness so that I would know that the God does not like my behavior and would change. Don't worry, we'll walk through them here. Sentence A expresses a simple awareness that others have mental states that matter in some way to their actions. This represents the most basic mentalizing activity and seems to be a capacity that infants and perhaps primates, dogs, elephants may possess, maybe other species as well. Okay? You've got a mind and it has some relationship to your activities. B expresses an understanding of the contents of another's mental states. Not just that you have some kind of internal something that guides your action, but I know something about that internal something. Okay? Two-year-olds and apes may have this ability. Okay? It's not just that God has a mental state, God doesn't like something. That has contents to it. Sentence C expresses awareness that others' mental states may include representations of my mental states. As in, he wants me to know, okay? He wants me to know something. Representation of your mental states about my mental states. And some sense that actions can be motivated by a desire to change others' mental states and not merely their behaviors. Now we're in the range of drawing complex relationships among mental states and their relations to actions. It's not clear that any non-human species alive today have this capacity, or that humans exhibit it before age 3 or 4. Okay? Sentence D takes things one step further. Still, all that is expressed in C is now attributed as knowledge of another. This is very high-order theory of mind, but qualitatively may not differ from C. Okay? That is, it could be the same toolkit that does the work. You don't necessarily need something extra, I suspect. Because if I can think about your thoughts, about my thoughts, it may be that I have the capacity to think about your thoughts, about my thoughts, about your thoughts. I just need to be able to represent a thought about a thought as a thought. You know, I can put it in a bracket and then I can move that thing around. Of course, even if D does represent just an extension of C, of the same cognitive capacity as C, it surely does require more conscious attention and effort. No wonder we have no good evidence then that D-type thinking appears in any non-humans and is challenging even for adult humans in many situations. But it is this D-type thinking, being able to understand that others share the same perspective, that gods want to change our thinking and behaving, that is required for homo religiosus. With this meta-representational theory of mind, humans can acknowledge, worship, and serve the same God and know that they're worshiping the same God. Meta-representational theory of mind then allows the cognitive accounts of religion to do more than explain just why people postulate gods. They may begin to explain why people collectively and jointly can and do interact with the gods in relationship. Meta-representation in the domain of thinking about mental states then may be the extra something that made our ancestors homo religiosus. Now, you may say, well, then there's that one little adaptation that the adaptationists are looking for, right? But I regard this meta-representational abilities as more plausible adaptation than religion as a whole. Okay, that's why this really differs from those other hypotheses. Because meta-representation is an incremental extension of regular lower-order theory of mind capacities. It's an extension of a capacity that was already there. It takes it just one step further. Instead of trying to wholly explain this whole constellation of beliefs and actions through some kind of genetic mutation. Okay? The reason I regard this possibility as distinct from the adaptation hypothesis is as well that adding meta-representation to the existing hominid cognitive toolkit would not only produce religion, may be the factor that produces many abilities and activities that we consider indicative of behaviorally modern humans. This is where I get really excited, this possibility. For the sake of time, I'll briefly suggest just three examples, but I think there are probably more. Cumulative culture, language, and morality. Okay? Cumulative culture. At least our nearest non-human kin are able, in some circumstances, to imitate actions. If I'm scrubbing my potato, washing my potato, if I'm a chimp and I'm scrubbing a potato, another chimp can see me do that and they might be able to scrub a potato as well. Okay, that kind of imitation of actions. Opening the possibility that some behaviors are the product of imitative cultural transmission. Okay, it's still controversial in the field, but there seem to be some cases that at least charitably can be interpreted as imitative cultural transmission in non-humans. Simple imitation, however, seems insufficient for the kind of rapidly developing cumulative culture evident in many behaviorally modern human groups. Here, too, the missing element may be meta-representation. Human toddlers, but seemingly not chimps, are able to learn a behavior based on what an actor intended to do rather than what the actor actually did do. Okay? If I try to do something and fail, a toddler knows what I tried to do and imitates that, whereas a chimp will do exactly what I did and fail. Okay? Such an ability to exercise what's been called goal imitation, as opposed to just ordinary dumb imitation, requires the ability to represent an action sequence in reference to the imagined mental states, the goals, the intentions of the other. Goal imitation neutralizes the ill effects of imperfect models. Okay? We make mistakes all the time, and thus speeds learning. Similarly, with meta-representational skills, a human can evaluate a tool or a behavioral sequence for its potential suitability to solve possible problems and speculate on how to modify or add to the tool to better solve the problem. That is, we don't have to just do trial and error. We can represent, well, how might I solve that problem? Okay? Multi-step action sequences, including the production and use of tools, may be accomplished without meta-representation, but meta-representation catalyzes greater flexibility, creativity, and potential to acquire and improve upon what others have done. Basic causal cognition with the ability to imitate can produce simple technology and something like culture, as can be seen in chimpanzees, but add meta-representation and you get the possibility of cumulative culture and rapid technological development that we see in behaviorally modern humans. Okay, language then. This one's a little more controversial. Non-human primates, whales, dogs, honeybees even, and other animals seem to be able to signal. Signals can be utterances, gestures, or even complex dances in the case of honeybees. What signaling does is prompt a behavioral reaction in the observer. For instance, cries can be uttered to prompt others to stop moving, run, climb, draw near, go away, attend to something or someone. Okay? What meta-representation seems to add is more flexible signaling still, as well as symbolically triggering mental states, instead of only triggering behavioral routines. When you talk to a dog, you tell it to sit, and it sits, it exhibits a behavior. It doesn't think, oh, he's asking me to ponder sitting. No, sit. Okay, border collies, really intelligent dogs. If you point at a pond that has ducks in it, you say, ducks. This very clever animal is likely to try to herd the ducks. I've seen it done. It's a marvelous thing. Swim out in the pond and try to round up ducks because that's what they do, right? They're getting a behavioral reaction to your utterance, your signal. When talking to a human child, the same gesture and utterance is likely to trigger, oh, she wants me to know that those things are called ducks. Okay, note there's mental state stuff going on there, not just behaviors. The child isn't going to go running after the ducks because you said, ducks. All right? Well, they might, but that's not necessarily the import that they take away from the utterance. Because of meta-representational abilities, humans can consider what mental state or intention is behind an utterance or gesture, including the possibility that the intention was to change a mental state. No, you're wrong. Oh, wrong. About my mental states, about my beliefs, about my desires, not about my behaviors. My behavior could continue exactly the same. All right? For these reasons, cognitive scientist Michael Tomasello has argued that it is this higher order theory of mind that I've been talking about that makes language possible. No meta-representation, no true language. You can get really complex signaling, but no true language, he argues. all right? Controversial idea. What about morality? Well, some scientists have suggested that the ability to empathize, to put oneself in the place of another and imagine his or her feelings, is a key component of moral reasoning. It develops our moral intuitions. How would it make you feel if you were treated that way? In fact, we use that line with children a lot when we try to train up their moral sensibilities. Obviously, this kind of empathizing requires meta representation. I have to put myself in somebody else's mental and emotional states and then realize that it's mine and not his and so forth. Animals can whimper or wince when another animal is in pain if they see this happen. But if I hear about a friend being insulted, I might feel for my friend and assume that the friend feels likewise. Because of meta representational abilities, I need not see the friend sobbing. Further, I can go beyond feeling for the friend and consider what the friend might think about the encounter and what decisions and actions the friend might take in response. Okay, I can predict future behavior based on this, putting myself in the other person's shoes, as it were. With the help of meta representation, sympathizing becomes mentalistic empathizing. If cognitive scientists of morality are right, this ability to empathize helps us build up moral intuitions. Additionally, meta-representation helps us move beyond just curbing our behaviors, because we might be punished if we don't, and punishing others' trespasses to try to change their behavior. Because of meta-representation, humans can consider their own and others' actions and potential actions and determine whether they are right or wrong, not just likely to be punished or not. Okay, if this analysis is right, it may be that when meta-representation was added to our ancestors' cognitive toolkits, they quite suddenly became capable of cumulative culture, language, moral feelings and judgments, and religion, all at the same time. All because of the addition of one incremental change. If so, then the toolkit that makes homo religiosus makes behaviorally modern humans as well. The two are identical and evolved concurrently. If the acquisition of meta-representation was the tipping point that made our ancestors both behaviorally modern and homo religiosus, you might wonder, well, when did meta-representation emerge? And as a developmental psychologist, I'd say it emerged sometime between your third and fifth birthdays. But in terms of evolution, it's a lot harder to say. My colleague here at Oxford, Robin Dunbar, has noted there's some rough linear relationship between neocortex size, okay, part of the brain, and behavioral evidence of increasingly complex theory of mind in living species. And so you can take that kind of linear relationship and you can map it onto the fossil record. And doing that kind of exercise leads Dunbar to tell us that we can be pretty confident that Homo erectus did not have enough brain power to exhibit meta-representational theory of mind. Such an ability likely evolved later, likely not until or after the appearance of anatomically modern humans. Okay? But we really don't know. Let me conclude then. Darwinism has forced a rethinking of the Genesis account of human origins. Given the gradual, continuous character evolution, the sudden appearance of humans, including their linguistic, cultural, and moral dimensions, together with the capacity and propensity for devotional relationships with God, might seem a bit too much to swallow. Surely we're dealing with highly allegorical material. Perhaps. But perhaps advances in the cognitive and evolutionary sciences, and cognitive science of religion in particular, gives us an opportunity to revisit Darwin and the possibility that in the beginning, the first modern humans were also religious humans. Indeed, not only might this concurred evolution be possible, it may be more probable than alternative accounts currently available. Thank you very much.